Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Adam Mueller, and I represent Mr. Moncada. My attorney registration number is 42176. Although each error identified in the opening brief independently justifies a new trial, I want to spend my time with you today talking about the first issue in the opening brief, which addresses self-defense and multiple assailants. Now, at the outset, I want to highlight a crucial point on which there is no dispute. It is undisputed that in Colorado, a jury must consider the totality of the circumstances, including the number of assailants reasonably appearing to be threatening the accused in evaluating a self-defense claim. And yet, the prosecutor in this case told the jury the opposite. He told jurors in his closing argument that under the jury instructions, they were permitted to consider the threat posed by Samuel Salinas alone. In closing argument, as discussed in the briefs, the prosecutor walked the jury element by element through the self-defense instruction and pointed out that the other person, in this case Samuel Salinas, was the only person that the jury could consider a threat from in evaluating the self-defense claim. And this was not a minor point of the prosecutor's closing argument. This was how the prosecutor began it. He framed the law before turning to the facts. To use the prosecutor's words, this was the key to the jury instructions.
There was no objection made to that argument.
There was not, Your Honor. We can see it's plain error, at least as to the as to both the instructional component of the first issue as well as the misstatement of the law of the first issue.
How, under the instruction that was given, how can his argument have been plain error?
I think under the instruction that was given, importantly, the phrase totality of the circumstances appears nowhere in the jury instructions. And I think that's crucial because if you go all the way back to the decision from the Supreme Court in Jones, the Supreme Court reversed the conviction in that case because the trial court had failed to supplement the standard self-defense instruction with additional language addressing the presence of multiple assailants. And following Jones, there's a long line of cases from this court which stand for the proposition that a self-defense instruction by itself is not good enough to inform the jury of the law of self-defense in Colorado in the context of multiple assailants. And this court said it most clearly in the decision in 1996, People v. Manzanares. I'll just quote that briefly. It said, "The pattern jury instruction given here for self-defense, standing alone, was not sufficient."
My question was probably ill-framed. Let me try it again. How can the prosecutor's argument be plain error if the instruction was proper?
Well, the instruction was proper as far as it went, Your Honor, but our objection to the instructions was that, in addition, the trial court failed to supplement the jury instruction with an additional instruction or language addressing the presence of multiple assailants.
I understand that argument, but if we reject it, then how can we find error with the prosecutor arguing within the ambit of the instruction given?
Well, I think the prosecutor's argument misstates the law in a fundamental respect, and that's why I started with the point I did, which is that it's undisputed that in Colorado, the jury must consider the totality of the circumstances, including the threat posed by all the assailants that reasonably appear to be threatening the accused. The dispute between the parties, at least on the instructional component of this issue, is whether the instructions were sufficient to communicate that principle of law to the jury, and I don't think they were.
Again, that's plain error because no objection was raised to
yes,
the instruction.
Plain error.
Do you agree that for purposes of our plain error analysis, we take the law as it exists today, which would include Riley, rather than the law existing at the time of trial, which was pre-Riley, which seems to be the position in your brief?
Well, I think either way it doesn't matter, Your Honor. There is case law from this jurisdiction, and I'd point to People v. O'Connell, in particular from 2005, that said the law at the time the trial court of the trial is what controls. And I think if that's the way to look at it, then clearly this was plain error because it was pre-Riley. And Jones, and I said, as a long line of cases that followed Jones, stand for the proposition that a self-defense instruction standing alone is insufficient. Now, this court's decision in the Riley case came out actually the day the jury was instructed in this case, in the day of closing argument.
I'm asking for what is your position on whether we decide the plain error question based on Riley or without regard to Riley?
I don't think it matters, John.
I
take no position.
Okay, thank you.
I think it doesn't matter.
Okay.
I think under either approach, this was plain error. As I said, prior to the Riley Supreme Court decision, I think there was no question that a self-defense instruction standing alone was insufficient. I don't think Riley changes that equation at all, and I'll talk about that now for a moment. In Riley, the Supreme Court affirmed the instructions because the self-defense instruction was supplemented by an apparent necessity instruction. And in particular, the apparent necessity instruction included the broad phrase, totality of the circumstances. And here, that phrase appears nowhere in the jury instructions. It's just not there. And either way you look at it, if Jones is the rule, unmodified by Riley, the self-defense instruction by itself is no good and is not good enough. If Riley's the rule, all that adds to the equation is an additional way to satisfy the undisputed proposition of law, which is that self-defense instruction by itself isn't good enough, but might be good enough if there's an apparent necessity instruction, or something along the lines of that that points to the totality of the circumstances. And we don't have that here. So I think under Riley or under Jones, it doesn't matter.
So Mr. Mueller, is your position then that so long as the jury instructions as a whole notified the jury that they are to consider the totality of the circumstances, there's no error, but it can be a little bit mushy as to what each instruction would say so long as the jury is advised?
Yeah, I think that's the basic proposition. The jury instructions, of course, as a whole, is how the court is to look at this. And then Riley, the court went to pains to read the self-defense instruction combined with the apparent necessity instruction and said, as a whole, those two instructions were good enough. But it's clear that the Riley court thought a self-defense instruction by itself was not good enough, and that's all we have here. And I think that's most clear.
Particularly in light of Justice Coates' concurrence, what specific statement in Riley do you rely on to conclude that the stock self-instruction, self-defense instruction alone is now inadequate as a matter of law?
Well, I'm not sure I can point to a specific quote, Your Honor, but I think the reasoning overall of the majority opinion is clear. The court reached its conclusion because the self-defense instruction by itself wouldn't have been good enough, and in that case was supplemented by the apparent necessity instruction. And I think if you compare the majority and the dissent in this case, in the Riley case, that becomes abundantly clear. And Justice Coates was writing for himself in that case. It was a concurrence that no one else joined, and he said it. I'd point to his concurrence, in fact. His concurrence said, the majority concludes that the instructions were sufficient only because, and I emphasize this in my reply brief, only because the self-defense instruction was supplemented with the apparent necessity instruction. Now, the majority and the dissent, of course, reached different conclusions in Riley, but they agreed on one thing. And that one thing was that the self-defense instruction by itself wasn't good enough. It was the self-defense instruction coupled with the apparent necessity instruction for the majority. And as to the dissent, they thought, in any case, the instructions were not sufficient there.
So what was the court here required to do in this case?
Well, one of the easiest things I think the court could have done was follow basically what the Supreme Court said in Jones, which is modify the language in the standard instruction to include the number of people reasonably appearing to be threatening the accused. That's one way. After Riley, it seems the court could have also given an apparent necessity instruction, which would have sufficed. Or generally speaking, the court could have just directed the jury to broadly consider the totality of the circumstances. And I'd point you again to the Manzanares decision of this court in 1996. In that case, the court affirmed the jury instructions because the self-defense instruction by itself, which the court said was not good enough, was supplemented by an additional instruction broadly directing the jury to consider the totality of the circumstances. And here, as I said, there's just nothing comparable. There's the phrase totality of the circumstances doesn't appear in the jury instructions.
Of the various alternatives you gave to Judge Lichtenstein, is any of them embodied in a stock instruction?
I don't believe any of them are, Your Honor.
So it's your position that it's plain error here for the trial court not to give an instruction that isn't anywhere in the stock instructions?
I think it is, Your Honor, and I don't think that's actually a controversial point, because if you go back to the Supreme Court decisions in cases like Hidrogo and Castles, all these self-defense cases, they stand for the proposition that the jury must be informed of the law of self-defense from the defendant's perspective, and a court must tailor the jury instructions to the facts of each case. Yes, a pattern jury instruction is a great way to start, but that's not necessarily sufficient in a case where multiple assailants exist. And I think Jones stands for that proposition, and the cases that have followed stand unequivocally for that proposition. And I don't think Riley really changes the equation at all, as I've said.
Is there any distinction in the fact that in Jones and Manzanares, those instructions identified the victim by name, and in this one it says the other person?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I don't think so for a couple of reasons. One, I'll go back to the prosecutor's closing argument. Any chance that the jury would have understood other person to refer to other people, more generally, both Santos and Samuel Salinas, I think that chance is wiped away, frankly, by the prosecutor's closing argument. When he starts the closing argument, he says, you must consider the threat posed by Samuel Salinas, not Santos Salinas, Samuel Salinas, and he repeats it. This is the key, he says. So any chance that the jury might have understood the instruction that way, I think, isn't the case here under the particular facts of the prosecutor's closing argument. And that's also why I started with that. I think it's a crucial point.
Let me ask you something. In the rebuttal argument that the prosecution made, they said, well, defense presents you with a scenario that would have you consider Santos as well as Sammy, and then seemed to say, well, that may justify be able to justify self-defense, but not here. Mm-hmm. Does that make a difference?
I don't think it does. I don't think it cures the earlier misstatement in the prosecutor's closing argument. I also think, and I apologize, I don't remember if this came in the first part of the closing argument or in the prosecutor's rebuttal, but the prosecutor said that Santos is not before this jury. He'll have his own case. And I think that's another kind of subtle way of the prosecutor to say, put what Santos did out of your mind, because under the jury instructions, it's not relevant. You don't get to consider it. And he emphasized that point repeatedly through the closing argument because he kept referring to Samuel being unarmed as opposed to Santos, where there was some testimony that Santos maybe had a gun beforehand and he undisputedly had a gun after the fact where he shot after my client as he ran from the scene. I see my time is almost up, so unless there are other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this matter. Regarding the self-defense instructions in this case, I think the arguments presented by the defendant can be broken down into two issues. First, whether the self-defense instruction given in this case was proper, and second, whether any further instruction on multiple assailants was required. In Jones, the Colorado Supreme Court primarily addressed a question of statutory interpretation underlying these two issues, which the defense counsel properly points out is now on dispute in this case. In that case, the trial court had held that as a matter of law, the jury could not consider the threat posed by anyone other than the victim when deciding if the defendant acted in self-defense. Jones rejected that proposition of law, and again, that's not disputed any longer. Jones then went on to hold that the jury instructions given in that case required reversal because they prohibited the jury from considering the threat posed by multiple assailants. The trial court's legal ruling, I think it's important to note in that case, would have also have prevented the defendant from even arguing that the jury could consider multiple assailants. Now, I believe we can't know for sure what the jury instructions in Jones said because they are not included in that opinion. But we do know what the jury instructions said in Riley. In that case, the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court addressed a self-defense instruction essentially identical to the one at issue in this case. If anything, I think the instruction in this case is more broad because it doesn't limit to a victim, but instead says other person. The Court of Appeals held in Riley that the jury instruction was erroneous, but that the error was harmless. The Supreme Court specifically rejected that reasoning, finding that the instruction was proper and did not prohibit the jury from considering multiple assailants. So I think the first part of the defendant's argument, that the self-defense instruction here was improper in some way, fails under the binding precedent of Riley.
Did the instructions here and the instructions in Riley, were they the same or was there a difference? Because my understanding is there was just a single self-defense instruction in this case, whereas in Riley, there were some instructions considered together that as a whole informed the jury that they are to consider totality of the circumstances.
And I think that's the second part of the defendant's argument, is whether there are some additional instruction required beyond the stock instruction. And I believe that issue is not resolved in Jones, because Riley specifically held that Jones does not require an additional multiple assailants instruction in every case involving multiple assailants. Further, I think that issue was not involved in Riley. I think that it was explicitly left open and unresolved by the Supreme Court in the footnote. And because this court is reviewing only for plain error and the present answer to that question is not obvious, the defendant's convictions should not be reversed. And in response to a question Judge Webb had for defense counsel, I believe the error must be clear both under the law at the time and under the current law in order for it to be reversible plain error. And I think the cases I cited, the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court cases reflect that idea. Should this court nevertheless address that issue, I believe the reasoning of Riley and Beckett compels the conclusion that in this case no further instruction was required. In Riley, the Supreme Court held that, and I'll quote this, so long as the given instructions properly direct the jury to consider the totality of the circumstances during its deliberations on reasonableness, those instructions will satisfy Jones. And in Beckett, the Supreme Court held that because the jury instructions there directed the jury to consider the defendant's, quote, reasonable beliefs, those instructions, and this is again a quote, adequately apprised the jury that it was required to consider the totality of the circumstances in evaluating the reasonableness of the accused's belief in the necessity of defensive action. So I believe that those two holdings compel the result, which I don't believe has been yet addressed by the Supreme Court, that the stock instruction alone would be sufficient to adequately advise the jury that that they need to consider the totality of the circumstances.
Including so Mr. Swanson, do you agree that the law is that the jury must consider the totality of the circumstances?
Now, I think that does raise an interesting question in this case, because the defendant was charged with a reckless crime rather than intent crime or a general intent or specific intent crime, because in this case the jury was required to find that the defendant acted recklessly. And the jury instruction that it was given, which is only statutorily required, before the statute was passed, you weren't even entitled to a self-defense instruction as to these reckless crimes, says that by finding recklessly, they necessarily require the jury to find that the defendant was not acting reasonably. And when they're considering recklessly, the instruction required by the statute says they may consider self-defense as a part of that. But I don't think that the instruction enables them to disregard anything, whether it fits within the self-defense instruction or not, to disregard any evidence regarding the reasonableness of the defendant's actions when considering whether he acted recklessly, which is the finding that they actually have to make, if that makes sense.
So then, was the jury here instructed that they could consider the totality of the circumstances, or that they must?
They were instructed that they had to find that the defendant acted recklessly. And they were also instructed that that when considering that they had to that they could consider whether the defendant acted in reasonable self-defense, and that as part of that they were to consider the reasonable beliefs of the defendant. And under Beckett, that instruction that they should consider the reasonable beliefs of the defendant adequately advises them that they should consider the totality of the circumstances.
Did Beckett address a multiple assailant issue?
It was a case that involved multiple assailants, but it was not specifically addressing this issue here. And I'm not arguing that Beckett holds that the stock instruction alone is sufficient. I don't think that Jones has addressed that issue or Beckett has addressed that issue, and I think Riley specifically left that issue unaddressed. I'm just arguing that I believe that the holdings in Beckett and in Riley are persuasive that that is the result that should apply in this case. On the issue of the prosecutorial misconduct, I think the key issue here is to look at the comments in context. Well, the comments viewed in isolation and in the cold record could, in the abstract, be interpreted as the defendant suggests. I think the rest of the prosecutor's arguments belie that interpretation, as does the defendant's decision not to object and the trial court's decision not to intervene, because it was, you know, it is a well-established rule that you can consider the multiple assailants. The defendant extensively argued that the jury should take into account the threat posed by the victim's brother, and much of the prosecution's argument also focused on that issue. I think taking the entirety of the arguments, there's simply no reasonable probability that the jury could have come away from the arguments with the impression that, as a matter of law, that issue didn't matter in this case.
Is that what the prosecutor told them during closing argument? That the key is you can only consider Samuel and not Santos?
I think in context, the defendant, the prosecution was arguing under the facts of this case, you can the actions by the defendant, or by the victim, are irrelevant to whether the defendant was acting in reasonable self-defense. And I went through my brief. I think a number of the arguments that he made regarding that issue. Because while multiple assailants can be considered, the fact that there are multiple assailants isn't determinative of that issue. They have to be acting in concert. You have to prove that the other person was actually having posing a threat in combination with that other person, and that this response of shooting the other person was a reasonable one, that there wasn't a lesser response available in order to use deadly force. And I think that the prosecutor's arguments, when taken as a whole, reflect his argument that those things mean that in this case, the actions of the victim's brothers don't justify the defendant's actions. If there are any further questions, I'll rest on my brief on the remaining issues. Thank you.
Just a few points. Your Honor asked whether the jury in this case was told that it must consider the totality of the circumstances. The answer was no. The answer is no. The jury was not told that. Nowhere did the instruction say you must consider the totality of the circumstances. And whatever dispute may exist about the exact wording of what instructions are sufficient, the one thing that's clear from Jones and Riley is that the jury must consider the totality of the circumstances. And as I said, that phrase appears nowhere in the jury instructions. And in addition, I don't think that by looking at the definition of reckless somehow changes the result here. I mean, admittedly, my client was convicted of reckless manslaughter and not second-degree murder, but if you look at the pattern definition of reckless, which is what the jury got here, that also doesn't say anything about the totality of the circumstances. So I don't think that by finding that he acted recklessly, the jury necessarily considered the totality of the circumstances as Jones and Riley obligate the jurors to do. A couple of other points. The fact that defense counsel got to argue Mr. Santos Salinas' actions in closing the argument is no substitute for proper jury instructions. I cited a number of cases in my reply brief that stand for that proposition. I don't think that's controversial, particularly when the prosecutor's closing argument, which was an argument about the law, the prosecutor wasn't applying the law to the facts in the portions that are particularly objectionable. He's going element by element through instruction 18, and he says it. Instruction 18, let's look at it. And he goes through the elements, and he says, this is the key. You can only consider the threat posed by Samuel Salinas, not Santos Salinas.
Mr. Mueller, I just have a question for you. I know you cited cases regarding the principle that closing argument is not a substitute. Are those plain error cases?
I'm not sure if they are, Your Honor. I don't want to stand here and say they are or they aren't because I'm not sure. But I don't think that actually changes the outcome, even if it was a preserved objection to jury instructions or a preserved objection to the prosecutor's argument. Again, I think in this case, when you consider the jury instructions, which I've argued are insufficient under Riley, under Jones, under any number of cases, that follow Jones, when you combine that with the prosecutor's misstatement, I think it's clear the jury here was told that the law in Colorado is that it can't consider the threat posed by Santos Salinas. The Attorney General pointed to the language other person and said that because it didn't refer to the victim, that might change the result, and the instruction here was somehow broader than the instruction at issue in Riley. But my client wasn't charged with killing Santos Salinas. He was charged with killing Samuel Salinas. And I think the only way the jury could have understood other person when combined with the prosecutor's argument was that they had to consider the threat posed by Samuel Salinas alone. Before I sit down, I just want to emphasize a few points. One, as I said, it's undisputed that the jury must consider the totality of the circumstances. That's the law. Everyone agrees. Two, it's undisputed that that phrase doesn't appear anywhere in the jury instructions. And three, the prosecutor's closing argument precluded the jury, in this case, from considering the threat posed by Santos. And for those reasons, I would ask this court to reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Appreciate the arguments of both counsel. Counsel are excused. The case is submitted. We'll issue written opinion in due course.